I'm Bill Radke, and it's the Week in Review with Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut, and Kathy Allen, political consultant for Democrats, Nikita Oliver, former mayoral candidate with the Seattle People's Party. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hey, Bill.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming in. I wish we had a brighter note to begin this on, but really from around the nation and in Washington State, the top story and the top topic of discussion this week is the fact that one person killed dozens and wounded hundreds of people in Las Vegas this week using legal weapons. So will this shooting change our gun laws? Well, here's California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
After Columbine, I thought we would act. After Virginia Tech, I thought we would act. After Tucson, when one of our colleagues was shot in the head and nearly killed, I thought we would act. After Aurora, that horrible thing in the movie theater, I thought we would act. And particularly after Sandy Hook, when 20 first graders were slaughtered, I thought for sure we would act. After Orlando, I thought we would act. And now, after Las Vegas, I hope senators will finally summon the political courage to stand up and say enough is enough.
And how significant, how major is the bill that Senator Feinstein has introduced? Her bill would ban the sale of something you may have never heard of, called a bump stock. This is a device that the Las Vegas shooter attached to his legal semi-automatic rifle to make them act more like machine guns. Why are they legal in Washington state? Well, Governor Jay Inslee told me there's no good reason.
There's really no purpose other than just spraying, you know, a waterfall of slugs in a large area. That's its only purpose. So massacre is its only reason for existence.
Even some congressional Republicans are calling for the bump stock ban. The NRA told the ATF to review the legality of bump stocks. Of course, the ATF has already said that bump stocks are legal. That's why they are flying off the shelves at a gun store near you. Knute Berger, we've been here before, as we've said. Is there anything different about this Las Vegas massacre?
No. The technique and whatnot is somewhat new. The idea of somebody being up in a tower with basically machine gun power. But Senator Feinstein was indicating, we've seen things like this and chronically. I think what's new is perhaps people will get the will to make broader political change, because you have the vast majority of people in this country, you know, want better background checks. They support kind of sane gun laws that
safe storage, higher age limits,
mentally ill, not having access to guns, that kind of thing. And I think you could also, and so you need something that's comprehensive, but the only way you're going to get it is by dealing with a systemic issue that's developed, which is through gerrymandering and through voter suppression and whatnot. You have a majority in Congress that does not reflect the majority opinions of the American people. And this is a systemic political problem that needs to be fixed in order for a pro-gun minority with great financing to be broken up so that you can get a more sensible majority view to pass legislation.
And the U.S. Supreme Court's considering gerrymandering right now. Kathy Allen, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, this is a lost leader. I mean, I have to take a look at this and say this has nothing to do with gun control. All that we see right now is a little bit of insider strategy by the NRA to be able to give them something, and so that real gun changes won't happen. This is all about just saying this one piece of equipment that nobody has heard of, that frankly, nobody knows how to use or likes to use if they do know it. What's happened is that people are now turning around and saying, you know, I guess they're really starting to change their ways. Oh, no, no. Au contraire. This is all about, let's just put this out there, make it look like we, too, can give away something. And literally, nothing will really change at all. This may pass, but nothing's going to change.
In fact, bump stocks were a reaction to the fact that you can't buy a machine gun, but you can buy a semi-automatic rifle. So what you get is different reactions to what's legal. And then when something might become illegal, it's newly popular. They sell a ton of them. And now the industry is about finding some other way to circumvent the law. Nikita?
You know, I think we actually see that a lot where we have a policy shift, and the policy shift sounds really nice, but at the heart of the matter, we haven't actually dealt with the cultural problem, not just around gun violence, but violence in particular. And when we look at these mass shootings, we see that they're usually predominantly white males, and there is a serious issue in this nation around toxic masculinity. And so while I think the policy shifts are important for creating some mechanisms within the system for safety, at the end of the day, if we don't make a cultural shift around looking at violence and gun violence as a public health issue and start to make some cultural strides, which I, you know, one of the things is about gun education. But I also think we look at our schools and we look at our young men, we really have to start educating them about what it means to be masculine, what it means to address patriarchy, and how do we really look at mass shootings from what they really are birthed out of. And, you know, people are looking for the storyline with this one. Why did he do it? What happened? What made it happen? You even saw the headlines immediately looking for mental health issues. But at the end of the day, if we're not willing to engage what we know across the board with these mass shootings, that there's a cultural problem, we're going to make policy shifts and we're going to continue to have the same outcomes.
Okay, so recognizing a cultural problem, Nikita, you might think that we get closer to that culture change with every mass shooting, but I noticed that when we took calls this week from gun owners, this is Bob in Snohomish saying essentially that these shootings have an opposite effect from that.
Sadly, it's kind of just another day that goes by. I mean, it's a tragedy what happened, but it's, I mean, you become so desensitized to it with, you know, Pulse nightclub and Columbine and then and Sandy Hook and all the ones you hear about, and you know, you hear about and that's the ones you hear about, not even the ones that you don't. So it seems like you hear about it and it's shocking at first, but you hear about another one and another and another and another, and it becomes to the point, it comes to the point where it's yeah it's another kind of a day in the life.
Another day in the life. So is Las Vegas a wake-up call or more like the snooze button?
Well, I guess I don't think it's either. It is interesting, the cultural issue, the historical issue, the mental health issue, they're all connected in the sense that, you know, we have a long history, as Nikita said, of violence, also of gun violence, as being part of how we built America. It's written into the Constitution. It's acted out in the old, in the New West. You know, think of the Bundy occupiers at Malheur. You know, an armed militia basically taking over public property, and they were treated with kid gloves. I think people in this country tend to be divided into two groups. They're those people who think guns make us safer, and those people who think guns make us less safe. And that's a big divide. And whether that's psychological, it's the amygdala, it's where, you know, what race and class you were brought up in, there's a big divide there. And, you know, and I get that. You know, some people, they want guns to be legal because they want to be able to protect themselves from danger. And so a shooting like this inspires them to go out and buy more weapons. That's often what you hear from the gun shop owners say. And I'm sure these bump stocks are probably selling like hotcakes.
You know, I also think the language that we use to tell the story really matters. Like, and I was thinking about the incident in Oregon and how we talked about Bundy and the folks with him as a militia, whereas if that had been brown folks or people who had a different sort of last name or a different story in the United States, we probably would have called it terrorism. And so I think we have to start reshaping the way that we talk about and think about violence across the board culturally if we're really going to have a shift in gun violence. It really is about what we've allowed to say is acceptable and what's not. And the truth of the matter is, violence against anyone is unacceptable. And we cherry pick which instances we're going to call for gun violence and gun safety and reform because we've also cherry picked whose lives are valuable and who has a right to have guns. Some of the conversations we have when we talk about guns and safety is when we think about the equity issue. Whose gun rights have been taken away? people who have been incarcerated or have been convicted of crimes. And then when you look at who's mostly perpetrating these mass shootings, they often tend to be white males, even though black and brown folks are the most affected by things like poverty and oppression. And so there is something very deeply rooted in the history of this country and in the violence of this country that is having a cultural impact on why we're seeing mass shootings emerge the way that they do.
Yeah, I think that the same thing happens is that I've noticed that what's really become norm is that when an incident happens, and then the actual kind of freeze moment where you listen to people talk a little bit about, well, what's happened? Where's the shooter? Is he alive or dead? Interestingly, never a woman. And more importantly, what happens after that is then we all become like these zombies pulled to the TV for a day, and that nothing else happens, that we become absolutely kind of like drones looking at this. And what happens to me is that I keep thinking, what is it that we take from this? Why are we just sitting there watching this? There's a deadening of what I think the spirit has become when it comes to these that bothers me from a point of view of social change. The fact that when it is something, if it's a person of color, or if someone is a Muslim and they are involved in any kind of a violent situation, all of a sudden it's an automatic 100% from the president right on down. This has got to be terrorism. But this guy decides to come in and pop people off from the second floor of a hotel. And what happens is that it's actually just one of those guys run amok. That's why
guys, as Nikita was saying, maybe the phrase that could come up in everyone's mind could be toxic masculinity instead of lone wolf or terrorist, etc. I want to talk about something, a local aspect of this. Knut, you referred to this briefly, the idea that someone's shooting from a tower. Yeah, this is something different, not unprecedented about Las Vegas.
Right.
I think we all know about the mid-60s University of Texas
shooting. Charles Whitman.
And there have been others. But this week, after the Vegas shooting, the sheriff of King County, John Urquhart, said that officers train for shooters in schools and in crowds, not firing from tall buildings.
We have to adopt. We have to change our response. We have to start to train differently for a scenario that we hadn't contemplated.
Urquhart called the Vegas shooting a game changer because we have tall buildings that loom over public venues. And he was even mentioning specific public venues, which, you know, I didn't want to think about. I didn't want to think about it. I guess I'm glad they're thinking about it. But he also said hotel staffs could be trained to spot weapons and red flags among guests. So I hope that pays well, being a first responder hotel staff member.
You know, at some point, what will happen to hotels and tall buildings, and in some cases already has, is what's happened with airports, where you're going to have to go through metal detectors and that kind of thing. So you can't just bring in a duffel bag full of a complete arsenal up to your room.
I think that the number of different things that happen is never going to change, and that police are going to be actually able to accommodate a whole lot more than, with due respect, what the sheriff says. Because most of the police that I was with last night were horrified that that happened, that nobody thought that this was something that required new training. What it required is people to be able to have a better update of anything that could happen. Because in terms of the cycles of
what police or the public having it, what do you mean a better update?
Both, actually, but the police primarily, that in terms of this year alone, we've gone through three cycles. One cycle is the different vehicles being used as a weapon. And then we've seen
driving
all of
trucks into crowds.
This is going to change. Oh. There's going to be cycles all the time. And what you need to do is to be ready for everything and not just be looking at training after one specific subject area. This is just much more. This is going to go on for a long time. I don't see a way to legislate around this.
I mean,
any final words on shootings before we talk about other things?
I just want to say, like, this all sounds very reactionary in the sense that we're going to make plans for new tactics from new types of shooters and new types of, you know, XYZ. And in reality, we do know what some of the underlying causes are of why we're having these sort of violent outcomes. And I think across the nation, we have to push towards seeing the public health issue and really making strides towards cultural shifts. In law school, I used to always get frustrated in class, and I had one professor in particular who would always say, Nikita, is this justice or not justice done? And we kind of had this banter of every time I would say, the courts are not the appropriate place to deal with this. I think the same can apply in some ways to policy when we start to develop reactionary strategies, that the reality is that there are some things that the proactive strategy is actually the culture shift. And that's very hard to do because it requires us to start to develop educational platforms and do work in schools and do work in neighborhoods, which is just not something that government or policymakers have been very good at doing, because we think we can legislate our way through social problems and we just simply can't.
You're treating the symptom and you're not treating the cause.
Well, speaking of politicians reacting to change, we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about how to choose the politicians who are going to be in charge of treating symptoms or treating root causes. We're also going to talk about the food that you eat, how it didn't get there by accident. It's food, it's culture, it's marketing. All that coming up on The Week in Review. So stick around. This is The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Let's continue with Nikita Oliver and Kathy Allen and Knute Berger talking about what mattered this week. You know, Seattle is choosing a mayor, and there was a thoughtful column this week in The Evergrey by a local real estate developer named Bo-Ting Zhang, who says voters think they're supposed to pick the candidate with the best policies. That's your job. Research the best policies on affordable housing and homelessness and police reform and transportation and land use and which candidate advocates which variation on each policy and whether they've been consistent or they've committed flip-flops. And that is so arduous and so unrealistic that it just leaves voters feeling guilty and tuned out. Instead, says Zhang, we should choose the candidate who says, I don't 100% know where the next 4 years will take us. I think it would be good to try X right now, but I'm totally willing to consider that's wrong. So here's how we can evaluate X with an open mind, and here are some backup ideas if we're wrong about X. Nikita Oliver, you were close to being one of those final mayoral candidates. Does that sound like a better approach to voting?
You know, I think different voters expect different things. One of the number one things I was told by consultants was name recognition is really what it's about. Often I was told it's not so much about your policy, it's whether or not people know your name. And while that's what I was told, I do agree there's something to voting based on a person's leadership and not just their leadership. What are their principles and their values? When the going gets tough and you're trying to get multiple constituencies to agree on a path forward, what principles do you go back to determine your priorities? I mean, Seattle has so many needs right now. And so what I'm interested in looking at a candidate is, as a leader, what are going to be the principles that they use to determine what we prioritize first?
But how do you assess that?
How do you
go by what they say their principles are?
Or? You know, I think track record matters. I think how a person has done their work, how they've ran their race, what interactions have you observed really matter. The struggle is how many voters actually have time to give that kind of observation to a candidate, and what communities do candidates typically make themselves available to? It's going to be who's considered to be your typical voter. It's not going to be communities like the ones that I spent most of my time in. And so there is definitely a contention there when we talk about constituencies and how do we look at leadership qualities as a value for voting.
Political consultant Kathy Allen, you know this topic well. What's your take on how we do choose candidates and how we ought to?
Well, what happens is that we spend a lot of time just trying to figure out that old question that comes from Camelot. I wonder what the people are thinking tonight. And really what they are thinking about is anything except policy. And no, they're not thinking about issues. There's another word, a phrase we use, which is issues are like tissues. You use them once, you throw them away. Hmm. The fact is that people consider issues as a reason to strut your stuff. Tell me and show me by how you touch a subject area. Tell me how that is leadership. And really what, because we live in the most educated city in America, major city in America, per capita, the fact is that we have people here who literally will talk a little bit about policy, but mostly what they talk about is personality, or they'll talk about image. Or
Nikita says it's all about name recognition, or she was
told. You
know,
it used to be that, but I think now what it is more than anything else, no, she didn't say that. She said that her consultant said that.
So she was told.
In all of that, I have to say, I don't think so. You have to have a name recognition. This campaign this year is about demonstrated leadership versus a pox on all your leadership. It's a matter of we have establishment and then we have the anti-establishment kind of perspective gone awry. What we have this year really is about, I've got something to show, I've led on these issues, versus someone who's a maverick and taking a look at nothing really that she has to offer. I think that the candidate Carrie Moon comes across as a great speaker. She's charismatic. The problem is that when it comes to what has she ever done for me lately, the public doesn't have a clue.
Well, my question, I'm quoting this writer who I thought was thought-provoking in her premise, which is that what we ought to be asking is, she gives examples. When have you been confident and wrong? How do you reality test ideas and challenge your own beliefs? Examples, please. When you see unintended consequences, how do you correct course? Examples, please. Knut, what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, it's awfully tough to get those kinds of questions answered in the forums where you get a chance to ask a question of a candidate.
Or maybe I should be asking these questions.
Yes.
If I'm so interested.
It's your job.
I'm not a debate moderator, but I get to interview people on the air.
First of all, I mean, I think if you're going to be a responsible voter, you need to listen to the candidates. There's so many forums. There's so many debates and panels. And, there's a lot to choose from. With the media coverage, radio, TV, websites and stuff. There's a ton of information. So it's really about how you process that. And I think some people don't process it much at all. I was talking with a farmer in Eastern Washington. He said, I always vote for the person. I always vote for the man. 99% of the time, that's Republican. There are no good other people?
Yeah.
They're always, people.
I don't vote by party. I vote for the Republican person, the man.
The Republican man, yeah. But, which is to say, I think a lot of voters, bring their bias and they're really not terribly persuadable. And then you have the Seattle conundrum, which is the number of rock solid conservative Republicans in Seattle is probably in the single digits or low double digits. Everybody else is some shade of liberal, progressive, socialist, and it's kind of where, how pro-business are you or how anti-business, or how neighborhood-oriented are you, that kind of thing. And you can find this out. I tend to start with ideas. I want to see if a candidate has ideas.
Is that different from policy?
Yeah, it is. Well, it's related. But what to me is, I get excited. I think a lot of Seattle voters like somebody with one or two big ideas. I'm going to do $15 an hour minimum wage. That's one of the ideas that Ed Murray used to get kind of to the left of Mike McGinn during that campaign.
Are you saying separate from what you think the right level of minimum wage is, the fact that it seems like a bold idea is value in itself
as
a voter?
Yes, and then the issue is, can that person implement that idea or those ideas? Or you throw an idea out to them and see how they respond. For example, with Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin, they were asked, what do you think about, universal public broadband in Seattle having a, and Carrie Moon said, great, I'd love to make that happen. And here's how I might do that. Jenny Durkin was like, well, I'll give that some thought, that type of the thing. So that you begin to sort of separate things out. And then.
Well, what are you saying about the I'll make that happen versus let me give that some thought?
If you're somebody who supports broadband, there's kind of a policy difference there. But then you get to the question that I think Kathy Allen was raising, which is who can actually do something? And, there are a lot of ways to kind of poke at that to find out how well have they thought this through? Have they researched it at all? Do they know of examples of other cities that have done that? How broad is their intellect?
But, that's kind of misleading in the sense that having done some of these candidate forums, the idea that someone asks you a question and you can answer it in detail or provide examples is actually kind of ridiculous in a sense, because once someone gets elected to office, they don't do all of this work by themselves. They have a huge team and a staff and a think tank whose job is to help them develop the most plausible, effective policy that can move us forward based on what their priorities are. And that is what I took away from reading the article, was just asking the question of, do we need all-knowing politicians?
Uh-huh.
Do we need candidates who can answer every question? Or do we need candidates who can articulate what kind of team they're going to have, what principles, vision, and value they're going to use in determining really important policies? I mean, there's obviously very key things this election, housing, homelessness, affordability, police reform, education, that our candidates need to be able to talk effectively about. But at the end of the day, I'm more interested in, who are they going to bring into that office? How are they going to manage their office? Are they going to be a micromanager? And are they going to be willing to say when they were wrong? Because sometimes you have to change course, which is something our last mayor just simply was not ever willing to do.
So what would you have answered, Nikita, if the question is, when have you been confident and wrong? Did you ever get that asked that? And what would you answer that to that?
I absolutely would answer. I do have an answer for that, actually. During the campaign, I was confronted by a parent at a house party whose child, because of the way our laws are constructed, a young person the age of 13 can decide that if they want to receive drug and alcohol therapy, they can receive it. But if they want to say they don't want it, they can say they don't want it and leave the place where they're getting services. And that mother came to me and said, you know, I understand why you have such a strong stance against the youth jail, but I need you to understand the impact of these policies on me as a parent trying to care for my middle school child who has a drug and alcohol issue. And she and I sat down multiple times to have conversations about how can we talk about a zero detention resolution while simultaneously understanding there are parents who actually have benefited from their children having to be involved with the institution of jails and police, and me needing to come to a place of understanding why she felt the jail needed to continue to exist.
Were you wrong?
I wasn't wrong in terms of my principle of understanding that jails do trauma and harm to children. Where I was wrong is I hadn't sat down and had enough conversations with parents who also believe that, but feel that their hands are incredibly tied and have absolutely no other option for caring for their middle school child because of the ways the laws are constructed. And what that helped me do was come to a much better understanding of how do you take a broad base of constituents who view, may have the same ultimate view that jails are bad for young people, but because of the way laws are constructed, their need for them is very different. And so she and I have been able to start doing some organizing work together since the election ended to really think about, if we're going to move towards zero detention, we also need to change laws that make it hard for parents to make sure their 13-year-olds get mental health and drug and alcohol treatment. And so me admitting that I had a gap in my thinking allowed me to have a really effective conversation with this parent that has actually grown our strategy for zero detention.
I'd rather go back to the other question. I like the other question much better, which was, I think, added to the question would be, okay, so which of these many departments inside City Hall will you not deal with, and you'll hire competent staff to be able to do so,
uh-huh,
and that you won't ever look at it?
What will you not do?
Yeah,
because
you're
so
do?
Focused
I
on
think
the,
that that's the more
your priorities.
Important. And
right.
I actually think it's okay to be able to say, who's going to walk with you? What kinds of people are you looking at to be in this new administration with you? Because what people, you know, we like to say that people want change, particularly after the raucous time we've just gone through in the last year, 2 years. The truth is what people are telling us is they want stability, that they see a city that is doing good things, but, you know, as opposed to jumping all over the place and changing all these ideas, stability. I want a dependability about services. I want dependability about how we treat people. I don't want to look like we're a bouncing policy ball all over the place.
Okay.
So I say, let's ask them about who's going to be with you.
All right. You're giving me great ideas for when I interview Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin. So that's great. And I'll leave you with this thought, that issues are like tissues. Thank you. That's a new one to me. I know that teamwork makes the dream work. But I've learned about issues and tissues as well with Kathy Allen and Nikita Oliver and Knute Berger. We're going to come back and talk about the food on your plate in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review with Knute Berger and Nikita Oliver and Kathy Allen. And as I was talking about yesterday on this show, what you eat is no accident. Food trends are partly about food, but they're also about tradition, habit, culture, and marketing. And this week, one of the Northwest's great food marketers died. The fact that you think of Copper River salmon as a delicacy has a lot to do with John Rowley, who in 1983 loaded 300 pounds of Copper River King onto an Alaska Airlines flight, and he publicized how that fish fattens up to swim this long, cold river, and it gets oily and meaty and worth $50 a pound. Knute Berger, you and I both knew John Rowley. You said that he laid the foundation for the foodies of today.
Yeah, well, and this kind of goes back to the 80s, which was an interesting moment, I think, in Seattle food history, because a lot of things happened. You had Rowley promoting Copper River salmon, which just became a bigger and bigger deal over the years. You saw the first microbreweries really starting up, like Red Hook. You had San Michel started to get international recognition with wine. The oyster business, Rowley played a role in that.
Oh, yes.
It began to boom. And there were all kinds of exciting promotions. I participated in 1984, where we flew the Nouveau Beaujolais in a Concorde.
That's right.
To Seattle, and when Mick McHugh did this big promotion, and we were
from Paris, right?
From Paris, yeah. And we were escorted over the Cascades by the Cairo news jet. You know, I mean, it was just, that was part of the kind of excess of the 80s.
That was so brilliant, to take a product that takes a long time to perfect and turn its unreadiness into a selling point, to in fact make it a race
to get
the new wine.
Exactly. And Mick McHugh, you know, of McCrory's and other places, was, you know, a brilliant guy in that same era. And so, you know, what happened was it was also happening in the kitchen with people like, you know, Tom Douglas and Kathy Casey and whatnot. There was just a real beginning embrace of local foods, but on this kind of mass market scale, not just in the kind of foodies talking to each other type of scale. And he was very much a part of that.
I was talking to a food writer, Xiaoqing Chow, about all this week, about why some foods catch on. And she said, well, sometimes it's because we learn what's local and what's fresh and what's oily in an Alaska river and what's sustainable and has a flavor worth taking the time to appreciate. But she said lately it's more about how it looks on Instagram.
It could be something like the unicorn frappuccino that Starbucks had, that all of a sudden all these kids, because, you know, I mean, it was this crazy thing. It was a limited time a drink, and everybody wanted to show off the fact that, oh, yeah, they stood in line for that and they ordered it and their picture and put a hashtag on it.
I would like to say that, you know, I was in Alaska at the time that he was actually trying to pull this all together. And what happened in Alaska is, of course, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute by, at the time, Senator Kim Elton actually got involved in it and helped pull it together. And they kept saying, well, now, how is this going to work? How are we going to make money off of this? And what they did is they quoted Ivers. They quoted Ivers as, we got to put some sex appeal with this, like, fish thing.
For those who don't know, this is the restaurateur Ivor Haglund, Acres of Clams.
Great promoter. Yes.
And funny, and Alaskans loved it. Alaskans would come down here and eat at Ivers. And so all of that notwithstanding, what happens is that it became part of the cult. We would say, should it be the Yukon River or should it be the Copper River? Oh, the Copper River sounds better. And what happened is we all, with horror that moved down here, came to see the Copper River salmon as the new $50 a pound. When we were looking at it up there, it was like, you know, the salmon was like, you know, 62 cents. Uh-huh. And we just had a heart attack when we came down here and found up that he had gone to town on it. The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute didn't get all that money. It was indeed the folks down here.
Nikita, is there any of this relevant to someone who hasn't been around here a while like us?
Yeah, you know, it actually, when I first started looking at, I didn't know who John Rowley was, condolences to his family. The first thing I actually did was text my friend Jossie Ross and say, is it some sort of like Columbusing to give credit to John when it comes to the salmon? Because, you know, Native folks have known what's up with salmon for a really long time.
Uh-huh.
And so what it drove me to start thinking about was this marketing conversation versus culture. And there is a certain type of marketing of culture that, you know, unfortunately reifies the ways in which we've capitalized upon things that Native peoples have known for a very long time. And so, you know, that's not something to hold John accountable for personally. But I think it is something, especially in Seattle and a city named after, you know, Suquamish Chief, we really have to be grappling with what does our marketing of cultural foods actually amount to? And to go back to this idea of who gets credit for it, who gets financial capital for it, and what are the outcomes there? Something that was 62 cents in Alaska, and I'm sure the Alaska Natives would be like, wow, $50, you know, so I think there's something to be said for how we capitalize upon other folks' culture. And then in the end, you know, what we do with credit. That's not to say that John didn't do great, incredible work, because I love salmon. You know, I kind of want some right now.
Uh-huh. How about some salmon poke, speaking of trends?
That sounds great, too. Okay. Have you noticed there's a lot of poke bars popping up all over Seattle? Is that a thing?
It is clearly a thing.
It is good.
And there's tuna poke people, there's salmon poke people, and there's tofu poke and octopus poke. In Seattle, you can get granular.
I was going to say that what's really happened now is we see the next revolution here is all about the different ethnicities and the food and the kitchens they have that have become the new four-star restaurants are all ethnic restaurants. And I think that that's the part about the celebration of what's going on here in Seattle is a good thing.
Which is crazy. As the city becomes less accessible, we have more ethnic restaurants becoming four-star restaurants. I mean, again, going back to just marketing and culture, the questions that forces us to ask about this city that we live in.
I remember participating in John Rowley's Oyster Olympics at Ray's Boathouse. I was a two-time loser in the slurping competition, and I opened the event with a limerick that partly went, if you want to be boringly fed, try a salad or burger instead. But for rapturous eating, there's nothing like feeding on something so recently dead. Oysters. We're going to talk more about, you know, food trends, I hope, because everybody enjoys that. The microbiome, the golden milk, don't get us started. We're talking on the Weekend Review with my guests, Knut Berger and Kathy Allen and Nikita Oliver. Nikita Oliver, former mayoral candidate, Seattle People's Party. Kathy Allen, political consultant for Democrats. And Knut Berger, the mossback at Crosscut. Thanks for working through the week with us, team.
You got it.
Thanks for having us.
KUOW's Week in Review.